I'm an alcoholic, a member of the Oakland Park Group. My name is Lynn. And first of all, before I forget, I would like to thank the committee for inviting me to come here this weekend and share. I consider it a great honor and a privilege to be able to do that. And also, this is a program of honesty, so what I have to admit, too, is that, yes, I did come to this in 1975, but I haven't been back since then. So, but I was, I came in 1975 because I was a newcomer, and my sponsor used to come to this, and so he brought me to it as his guest. And, I really enjoyed it and had a wonderful time. And the reason I never came back after that was because I didn't have any money and I was too poor. But it's a great honor and a great privilege to be here today. Also, and to be honest with everybody, my name is actually Linwood, but I quit going by that name several years ago. My best friend in grade school, his grandmother could never remember my name, but she knew it was Wood, so she used to call me Deadwood. So I was very insulted by that, so I just took the wood off of my name. But anyhow, I'm supposed to tell you a little bit of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I grew up in a very small town in Michigan. The population of the town when I grew up in it was about maybe 500 or 600 people. And from the very beginning, I knew I didn't belong. I felt different. And a couple of reasons for that were I was the last of 8 children. And when I came along, I think my parents were just tired of raising children. So I wasn't really raised. I just sort of grew up. And I had 2 older sisters who were supposed to be my babysitters when my parents were at home. And of course, they were teenagers, so they wanted to go out and, date and do stuff like that. So what they would tell me is, if you dare tell the folks we left you alone, we'll take you back to the orphanage because you were found on the porch in a basket. And I believed them because I didn't feel like I was a member of that family. And I was the last of 8 children, and all of my brothers and sisters that went to school, they had all had the same teachers that I was having coming along. And what I always heard was, well, we can tell you're a Fritz, but you're not as smart as the rest of them were. And then they would say, we can tell you're a Fritz, but you're not as good looking as the rest of your family was. And then the ones who had had my brothers, they'd say, well, we can tell you're a Fritz, but you're not athletic like your brothers were. So growing up, I knew I was different. I knew there was something wrong with me, but I didn't know what it was. Anyhow, I graduated from high school. And growing up, one thing I need to remember is that most of my brothers and sisters have been raised during the Depression, so my folks couldn't do very much for them. And when I came along, the economy was reviving, and so my parents could do things for me they couldn't do for my other siblings. So I grew up being very spoiled and feeling very entitled. And you hear people say that thing about, well, I have checks in my checkbook, so I must have money. Well, that was sort of my philosophy my whole life. But anyhow, I left this very small town of about 500 or 600 people, and I went to Michigan State University. And all of a sudden, I was thrown into this crowd of about 30,000 people. And I had no idea how to cope with people. I realized I had no social skills. I didn't know how to make friends. And the only feeling that I felt was just a feeling of terror. And what happened was I'd only been there a couple of weeks, and I was invited to a party off campus, and I went to it. And like Jim, I was a late bloomer because I'd never had a drink until then. I was 17. I went to this party, and they were serving wine. And so I had a little bit of wine. And in fact, I had quite a bit of wine that night. And what I remember, you know, what I remember about that night was I drank that wine, and I could feel it burning all the way going down. And then it hit my stomach, and there was like this fire in my stomach. And all of a sudden, this feeling of warmth and contentment came over me. All of my inhibitions were gone. And all of a sudden, I just became the life of the party. And what I need to remember about that night, too, is that that drunk was just like all of the rest of my drunks for the next 20 years. Because what happened is I got drunk, I blacked out, I passed out, and when I came to, I was in trouble. And I followed that pattern for the next 20 years. And I kept trying to get that elusive feeling that I'd had when I took that first drink, that feeling of euphoria. And I never was able to get to that plateau again. I would almost get there, and then I would just flop right by it and just be drunk, you know? But I kept trying to get that feeling back. You know, I drank in college every time I got a chance. I graduated and got a job teaching school. And as soon as I had my first paycheck, I became a daily drunk. My routine was the same. I'd get home from work, I would take a little nap, have a little something to eat, and I would go to the bar, and I would stay there until they closed. And I started that as soon as I had my first paycheck, and I continued that process through until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and had my last drunk. Now, in Michigan, I was arrested once in Michigan for drunk driving. And then the next summer, I decided that I would move to California because I realized the reason I had gotten arrested was because it's very cold in Michigan in the wintertime. And so you have to drink a lot to keep warm. So I figured, well, the reason I moved to California, it's warm there. And I had two cousins that lived there, two gals. And so I thought, well, I'll move to California, and then my life is going to really take off. My life is really going to be different. And I don't know about the rest of you, but I always had great illusions of what I was going to do. And I told myself when I got out to California, what I was going to do is I was going to go to the beach, and I was going to swim every day. I was going to play tennis. I was going to play golf. And the only thing that I did when I got there is drink. And I didn't want to not meet some of those goals. So what I decided to do is I found a bar in Long Beach, and they had a glass front. The whole bar was glass front. And you could sit at the bar and look out at the beach. So I decided, well, this is my going to the beach. I'll go there and I'll drink. So that was what I did. I was one of those people, too, who I loved the bars. I did most of my drinking in bars, and I loved them. But the only problem was, is every time I got to a bar, all of the really interesting, attractive people had left and gone to another bar. So I would have to get in my car to try and track them down and find them where they were. So what that meant is I started getting arrested a lot for driving under the influence. And in California, I was arrested 6 times for that. And so I went to DUI school in California 3 times. The last time I got arrested, though, I had to spend some time in jail. And when I got out of jail and got home, there was a letter from the State Department of California saying, due to my excessive arrest, they were revoking my teaching credential. And they in the letter, they said if I wanted to have a hearing, I could. I don't know anybody else sitting in this room, but I had an awful lot of arrogance then. I still have it today. I constantly fight with it. And I read that letter, and I thought, well, if they don't know what a good thing they're losing me, that's their tough luck. So I came here to Florida. And I said to myself, okay, when I get to Florida, things are going to be different. And they were different. They got progressively worse right away. And I remember the first time I was arrested here in Florida, and I went to court, and they sent me to an alcoholic counselor. And this alcoholic counselor, she was a very dear lady, very sweet, and she said to me, "Oh, you are so lucky." She said, "We have just started this new course here. It's called DUI School, and we send all first-time offenders to it. And so I'm going to sign you up for DUI school." So I went to DUI school here three times, too. So I'm a graduate of that school six times. The thing I remember about DUI school is they always had three jars with three brains in them. And one was a normal brain, one was the brain of an average drinker, and one was the brain of an alcoholic. And I always used to look at those brains, and I always decided mine must be the brain of the normal drinker. The other thing is they used to show us these really horrible, horrible movies of accidents. And I used to watch those movies, and I would think to myself, well, God, those guys must have really been sissies. I could have been in an accident like that and got out of it. And what I found out about that is somebody told me at a meeting once, you can't frighten an active alcoholic. And, you know, I know that that's true. You just can't frighten us when we're active. The last time that I got arrested in Florida, I always like to remember this time because I came to and I was in jail up in Deerfield Beach. And I remember coming to in the morning and thinking, I don't want to get out of jail. Because if I get out of jail, I'm going to have to start drinking again. And so I said, well, I thought to myself, well, what I'll do is when I go before the judge, I'll just plead guilty, and I'll tell him I want to stay in jail. Because if I stay here, I'll have a cot, and I'll have three meals a day, and I won't have to drink. The only problem was I had two dogs at home, but in my infinite wisdom, I said to myself, I'll explain to the judge about my dogs. I'll have him send a sheriff officer to my house, pick up the dogs, and bring them back here, and the three of us get them in the jail cell together. And, you know, I thought that was perfectly logical. I think you're starting to become institutionalized when you have those kind of thoughts. Anyhow, my employer came and bailed me out, and when I went before the judge, he told me, he said that he couldn't hear a plea if I didn't have legal counsel because by that time they were tying computer systems together and he had my arrest from Michigan, California, and Florida, and he wasn't real pleased with what he saw. So he told me I needed to have an attorney because the only other alternative was a year in Rayford. So I didn't have any money to hire an attorney, so my employer said, well, Catherine and I will hire your attorney for you, and then if you don't go to jail, you'll just have to pay us back out of your salary. And he said the only stipulation is we get to pick the attorney. So when you're between the rock and the hard place, you agree to stuff, and I said, that's fine. So anyway, he hired this attorney for me. His name was Minton B. And Minton called me, and he said, well, I'll be in touch with you in a few days. And so I said, okay. So I kept waiting and waiting. And finally, this attorney called me, and he said, well, we really need to get together and talk about your case. And I said, okay. So he said, well, why don't you meet me at the ranch house at 7, and we'll have coffee. So I met him at the ranch house in Pompano Beach. It was on Atlantic Boulevard at the Intercoastal there. So anyway, I'm sitting in this booth with this Mitten, who I didn't know from Adam, and we're drinking coffee, and all of a sudden, a series of men came into the restaurant, and one of them would sit down in the booth, and he would tell a little bit of his story, and then he would get up and leave. As soon as he would get up and leave, another guy would sit down and do the same thing. And I was really getting annoyed. I thought, I don't care about these losers. What is he going to do for me? So At this point, he looked at me and he said, "Have you ever been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous?" Now, I don't know if I mentioned this, but when I got out of jail in California, part of my sentence was to go to so many AA meetings. I think I had to go to 8. And so I went to those meetings, but I had no idea why they had sent me there. And I didn't have a driver's license, so a couple of friends used to take me to the meetings, and they would wait at a bar across the street for me. And so when the meeting would be over, I would go there to meet them, and I would be haired off because they were half in the bag, and I'd have to drink real fast to get caught up. And I didn't know about the anonymity of the program, so I would tell them about the meeting, and they couldn't figure out why I was being sent there either. So I think it was sort of like the blind leading the blind. But anyway, when Minton asked me that, I gave him my most sincere smile and said, "Oh my God, no, but I've always wanted to go to one." And he said, "Well, tonight's your lucky night." And he took me to the 101 Club. And it was on a Thursday night, and the Palm Group met there. And the Palm Group wasn't meeting there until about a year ago. They just disbanded. But what I remember about that night is I walked into that meeting, and I was 37 years old. All of the people in that group were about the age that I am today. And I looked around, and I said, "Of course they don't want to drink. They're too old. I've got a lot of drinking to do yet." And anyway, the meeting was over, and he gave me a copy of the Where and When, and he said, "No, if you want what we have, this is where you get it, and don't call me, I'll call you." So I remember looking at that Where and When, and I couldn't figure out where any of the addresses in that little book were. Then I looked at the coding where it said open and closed meetings, and I said, "Well, I can't go to closed meetings because he didn't give me a card to say I'm an alcoholic. I can't go to the open meetings. What if, my God, what if somebody should see me, one of my neighbors?" And so I thought, well, I guess this place is a safe place to go. So I went to meetings at the 101 Club. Now, what I have to admit is I didn't go because I wanted to get sober. I went because I thought if I go to the meetings there, he will see me there. He'll think of a brilliant defense for me, and I won't have to go to jail. So that's the reason I went to meetings. Now, in going to those meetings too, I didn't realize you were supposed to quit drinking. I thought that was part A of the program as you went along a while. And why I thought that is I looked at the steps on the wall and I keyed in on the second step, which said we would be restored to sanity. And I said to myself, that's what this program is. These people are going to restore me to sanity, and then I will be able to drink again. And that was what I actually thought. So what happened is eventually I had my last drunk. And what happened, it was a Friday night, and I went to the 101 Club, the meeting there. And the meeting was over at 9:30, and I didn't know what to do with myself, and I was restless, irritable, and discontent. So I said, "I know, I'll go to the 12-step house in Fort Lauderdale." So I went down there and I stayed till they closed at noon, at midnight. Yeah, midnight. And when they closed, I walked out the door, and it was the 12-step house. Then was on Andrews Avenue, and right across the parking lot from the 12-step house was McGuire's Bar and Grill. I said to myself, this is divine intervention. The bar is right there. I don't have to even drive. So I went over there and I ordered a beer, and I said to myself, if you can make this beer last for an hour, you'll know you're not an alcoholic. So I sat there and I watched the hands on the clock go around, nursing a beer, longest hour in my life. The hour came around and I said, see, you're not drunk. I ordered a second beer, and that's the last I remember of that night. The rest of it's just a complete blackout. You know, in the morning when I came to, I was again in one of those disgusting situations that we wonder when we wake up, how did we get there? And I'm an example of if you bring the body, the mind will follow. Because I came to that morning and I made my complete surrender to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember saying, God, I don't care what I do to get sober, I'll do anything. And so I came back to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous because I wanted to get sober. And I heard you were supposed to get a sponsor. So I saw a guy around the clubhouse. I asked him if he would be my sponsor, and he said yes. And he said, the only thing is, he said, what I want you to start doing is in the morning when you get up, I want you to ask God to please keep you sober for the day. And if you're successful, when you go to bed at night, have the common courtesy to tell him thank you. So I started to do that, and I thought, this is, you know, this was the first time in my life I'd asked somebody to please do something and then thank them for it when it worked. He also told me that he wanted me to call him every day. And I kept hearing in the rooms, I was the most important person in the room. Well, if I was that important, why did I have to call him? He should call me. So he was a lot smarter than I was. And he would call me and say, I'm waiting for you to call me, and then he would hang up. And I thought, I have chosen the wrong sponsor. This guy is stupid. He had me on the phone. Why have I got to call him back? But I realized that was all part of him getting me to get out of myself. And anyway, I started going to meetings and following his directions. And then I had that fateful call from my attorney saying, your hearing with the judge is set. And I was full of fear and trepidation. And he said, it's not going to be in the courtroom. It's going to be in his chambers. And if you have somebody you want to come with you for support, ask them to come. So I asked my sponsor if he would go with me, and he said yes. So on the appointed day, we showed up in the judge's chambers, and I turned to Minton, and I said, what have you done about my defense? And he looked at me, and he gave me a very serene smile, and he said, oh, I turned that over to God. I wanted to leap across the boot and rip his throat out. What did he mean he turned this over to God? So anyway, the judge comes in, and the judge is talking, and I'm listening, and I'm thinking, oh, this is not going well for me at all. And all of a sudden, what happened is a man walked into the room, and he stood at the back of the room for a while listening, and then he said to the judge, he said, excuse me, Your Honor, before you pass sentence on this man, can I talk to you for a few minutes? And he said, yes. And I recognized him as a man I'd seen at the 101 Club. I didn't know him, but I'd seen him at the meetings. So he and the judge left, and I said to myself, oh, holy, you know what? He's going to tell the judge every pathetic thing I've ever shared at a meeting. I'm really going away now. And anyway, they were gone for a few minutes, and the judge came back in the room, and he said, I don't know if you know it or not, but you have a real friend in Roger. Because he told me that he's seen you at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he thinks they can do more for you than prison would do for you. So based on his recommendation, I'm going to give you a suspended sentence. Well, you know, I was just overblown. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to think. And, of course, being suspicious by nature, my first thought was, okay, what does this Roger guy want from me? Doesn't he realize I don't have anything left? And it was amazing because I ran into him a couple of days later at a meeting, and I thanked him for helping me, and I said, but what is it that you want from me? And he said, I don't want anything from you. He said, I'm getting older, and a lot of these younger guys, they can't identify with me. So just, you know, talk to the newcomers and help them get sober, help them on their way to sobriety. So that was what I started to do. The amazing thing about that story for me is he wasn't even supposed to be in court that day. He was a volunteer who delivered papers to the different judges' chambers. And the man who was supposed to be there that day had gotten sick, and he had called Roger and asked him if he would take his place in court. So, you know, when Minton said he turned that over to God, all of a sudden I knew what he meant, because here was a man who was there who wasn't supposed to be there, who had seen me and believed in the power of Alcoholics Anonymous and put in a good word for me. and I'm forever indebted to him for that. So what I did is I got active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I used to always go to meetings at the 101 Club, and there was a fellow there, his name was Ronnie, and he was a member of the Margate group. And he kept saying to me, oh, come out to my home group, come out to my home group. Well, I didn't want to go out to Margate, and I didn't want to go to his home group. But one night, I said to myself, okay, let me go to his home group. If I go once, I'll never have to go again. He will never ask me again. So I went out there, and the meeting was over, and he said to me, oh, why don't you stay tonight? Tonight's our business meeting. And I didn't know the day groups had business meetings, and I stayed because I wondered what you guys talked about at a business meeting. I thought it must be high finance, what you did with all that money in the basket, you know? And anyway, I stayed for the business meeting, and the next thing I knew, they had elected me coffee maker for that group. And the group met twice a week. It had one of those old 100-cup percolators that took forever to make the coffee. And I remember that night was over, and they gave me the keys. It was at the old Lions Club on 441. They gave me the key to the building, and they said, be here at least an hour and a half before the meeting to get the coffee started, because it takes the pot an hour to make the coffee. So I thought, good grief, what have I gotten myself into? So the first night I was there, I got the coffee started, and I said to myself, now I hope nobody shows up until just before the meeting. And, you know, God has such a funny sense of humor because some newcomer came looking for a meeting like right after I'd started the coffee. And I said hello to him, and he said hello to me. And then we sat in abject silence for an hour with just glug, 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 the coffee pot going. I thought, oh, my God, is this going to go on every week? But, you know, what I realized when that happened is that I had to start to learn how to talk to people because I still did not know how to talk to people. What do you say after say hello? And I asked my sponsor about it, and he said, well, you know, you always have your drunken experiences. You can talk about those. So, you know, that was the starting off point for that. But the other reason I was so grateful to have a home group is because I'm not one of these people that came to you, walked in the room and said, oh, my God, I feel the love. I'm home. I walked in. I said, good God, what have you done to me this time? You know, and also I've heard people say that the obsession to drink was lifted right away. My obsession to drink was not lifted right away. In fact, I had it for a long time. But the thing that saved me is people told me I didn't have to drink even when I wanted to. And I never knew that before. I always thought if I wanted to drink, I had to drink. And so there used to be nights when I wanted to drink so bad, but I would tell myself, I can't drink because I have to be there to make the coffee for those alcoholics. If I'm not there and make the coffee, what are they going to do? So, you know, we're delusional and we're sick. But as long as we just keep going, just keep bringing the body, you know, and eventually the mind does follow. Anyhow, I got real active in service in a lot of different areas. I had this old ratty car, and it became the official 12-step car of Broward County. We just flew all over, dragging people out of the bars and into the meetings and, making coffee for groups and cheering and being greeters. And then my sponsor said to me that he thought one of the things I should do is I should pick up prisoners at the work release program and take them to meetings. And institutions was a lot more flexible back then than they are today. So anyway, he took me out there, and they made arrangements for me to pick up a group of prisoners once a week and take them to meetings. And it was real interesting because they didn't really want to go to AA meetings. They wanted to go to these meetings that were called alcohol information meetings. And there were a few of them around, but they were in strange neighborhoods. But anyhow, I used to pick up three guys and take them to these meetings. you know, scared to death. Oh, I'm picking up these prisoners, you know. And we'd get in these really goofy neighborhoods, and they'd say, oh, don't worry about the car. We'll tell our friends to watch it. Well, it took me a while to figure out that these guys didn't really want to go to the alcohol information meeting. They wanted to meet their girlfriends who would show up at the meetings. But, you know, I figured, well, at least maybe we planted the seed in a couple of them. So I did that for a long time. And I got real involved in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was sober, I guess, 2 years. And I suddenly realized that I was just as unhappy sober as I had been drinking. And I thought, well, what's wrong? Why am I so unhappy? Why am I so miserable? And, you know, I still had all of my character defects and all of my shortcomings. The only ones I'd gotten rid of were the real obvious ones, like stealing and lying. And the only reason I got rid of those was because I didn't want to get caught, not because I had any great spiritual experience. And, you know, I used to hear people talk about the program and the fellowship, and I thought they were talking about the same thing. I thought they were just using two different words to confuse me. And so all of a sudden, what I realized is I had been very active in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I had done nothing about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was when I had to start working the steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and, you know, following the suggested program of recovery that we know today. And so I did that, and, you know, my life slowly began to change. When I first got sober, I had a very menial job, paying me less, I think, than what the minimum wage was. But at least, it gave me beer money when I was still drinking. And I thought that was going to have to be my lot for the rest of my life. And what I realized through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I could change that if I chose to. And again, somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous came to my aid because they said, we can't get you a job, but we can get you an interview. And they got me a job with this company called Metro Media Long Distance. And I got a job working as a representative, taking calls from happy, satisfied customers. And that was back in the day when you had the CodeJet to dial and all the rest of that nonsense. So the customers not necessarily were happy all the time. But anyhow, you know, what I found suddenly was if you gave your employer a good day's work for whatever salary he was paying you, they appreciated it. If you didn't argue with them about everything they asked you to do, they appreciated that. If you came in and just did your job, they liked that. And so that's what I started to do, but only because that's what you told me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happened for me is I was able to have a very successful career that was very rewarding, both financially and intellectually. And I never thought I was going to have that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor told me that service would keep me sober. And I've always been involved in service. I got very involved in intergroup. I fell in love with intergroup. And I was involved with them for about 12 years. And I went through all the different seats they have on their board and eventually became the Broward County Chairman for Intergroup, which I liked. But what I liked even better was I used to go and volunteer on the phones once a week and talk to the drunks that were calling in, and I loved that. But after about 12 years with Intergroup, I decided in the spirit of rotation, it was time to move on. So I left Intergroup and I got involved in general service for a while. I was a general service rep for a couple of years, and then I became an ADCM. But what I found out that just wasn't my niche in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the beauty of the program, is there are so many niches in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just have to find the one that I feel comfortable in and the one that I enjoy doing. You know, when I finally came to this program, nobody in my family wanted anything to do with me. None of them wanted to talk to me. fact, the last call I had from one of my family was, don't ever call us again. We don't ever want to talk to you again. And, you know, over the years, all the damage that I've been done has been repaired. And I have, a close, loving relationship with this family. And I think it's amazing because I have these great nieces and great nephews who I've never really met. And when I do meet them, they just think that Uncle Limit is just the greatest guy on the earth. And, so thank God my brothers and sisters didn't really tell them about me. But, you know, that's so great. And one of the really important things that I want to close with is when I came to the program, Alcoholics Anonymous, I absolutely hated myself. And when they talked about resentments, the biggest resentment I had was the resentment that I'd ever been born. And I didn't like me at all. And I remember my sponsor early on telling me that he wanted me to start doing some affirmations. And he said, what I want you to do is every day I want you to look in the mirror and say, I love you. Well, you know, I would look in the mirror and I would say, I, and then my eyes would have to go down to finish the sentence because I couldn't even look in the mirror and say that to myself. And, you know, what happened through following the example of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I came to the part where I started to like myself, and then I got to the part where I actually love myself. And so sometimes today I really spoil me, and that's okay. I don't mind doing that. And, you know, the other thing is I thought I was going to think my way into right acting, and what I found out is I had to act my way into right thinking. And what I used to do is I used to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would watch you people, and I would start to imitate you, and I would do the things that you did. And what was even better, I would say the things that you said. And when I was first sober, I would go to meetings, and I would listen to what people shared. And if I was in a meeting and I heard Kathy share something really terrific, the next day when I was at a meeting, I would look around, and if Kathy wasn't there, I would share what she had shared. And the people would say, oh, you're doing so well for being so young. But, you know, that was how I learned. I watched you people, I watched how you acted, I watched you did, and I tried to imitate what you did. And, you know, they say they can train a monkey that way, so if they can train a monkey, why not an alcoholic, you know? We're pretty smart. But anyhow, you know, when I came to this program, all I wanted was just not to go to prison for a year. That was all I wanted. And, you know, if that would have been my lifelong ideal, I would have really shortchanged myself a lot. You know, I have friends that I've had for years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's completely foreign to my nature because I used you up and threw you away. And you've given me a life beyond my fondest dreams. I've been able to do things I never thought were possible, go places I never thought I would, and meet the most fascinating people in the world, because I don't know if you know this or not, but we are the most fascinating people in the world. And when I was drinking, I used to think the really interesting people were the drunks in the bars. Believe me, they've got nothing on us. So anyway, I appreciate your listening to me and letting me share, and thank you so much.